Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to the Free Cities Podcast, episode number 24. I hope you've had an inspiring and productive week. I've just returned from our Free Cities Foundation trip to Portugal and Montenegro, and I can happily report back that we've managed to clock up over 20 new and fascinating interviews for this podcast. We've been discussing everything from what it was like to live in a medieval city-state to what it might be like to create a free city on an asteroid. Stay tuned for those. And of course, I've also been speaking to people about liberty and freedom in all of its myriad forms. And today's episode is one such conversation with a wonderful couple by the names of Matt and Terry Kibbe. Matt and Terry are the founders of Free the People, which is an educational foundation charged with the mission of tuning in the next generation to the core values of personal liberty and peaceful cooperation. Now, I met them both in Lisbon, where they were speaking at LibertyCon. And were it not for both of our incredibly strict schedules over that weekend, I would have happily spoken to them for much longer, since they have such a wealth of experience in the worlds of both legacy media and new media. In our conversation, we mainly discuss the current media landscape and what might be the best tools and strategies for communicating our message to the hearts and minds of people in today's highly volatile and changeable world. The marketplace of ideas has never been more universally accessible than it is at this particular time in history. And Terry and Matt are most certainly amongst those at the sharp end of the wedge when it comes to communicating ideas of liberty and freedom. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Don't forget to subscribe and rate us on your podcasting app. And you can always send feedback via the usual social media channels. But in the meantime, however, just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Matt and Terry Kibbe. Well, I think we have quite a lot in common. I come from the legacy media as well. I think you sort of have your fair share of that in the past, don't you? So I think what I'd like to talk about is the media and spreading the message, and which I think is relevant to all of us. Myself personally, I've come right through from the analog world. Without guessing your ages, I'm gonna say you've come the same way. Is that right?
Yeah,
you remember the good old days when
we remember 8-tracks.
Right. Well, I remember pre everything. I was a photojournalist in the beginning, so, and I was shooting on film and rushing back to an office and developing and all this kind of stuff, but. It's quite astonishing for us all to think about how different it is now. Maybe if we could start, let's talk about what your experiences maybe in the sort of transition that we've come through, and then obviously we can move into sort of how the best way to approach spreading good ideas is currently.
Well, so I was once introduced as someone with a checkered past, which I thought was really interesting, and it was describing my non-linear career path. I started out as an engineer and then moved into the public policy world. I worked at the Cato Institute, Competitive Enterprise Institute, and other organizations like that. And then Matt and I started Free the People 6 years ago now. Time flies. And we did it, and we moved into video storytelling because we recognized that, white papers are important, for the seven people that read them. And so we just looked at video and social media as the way to reach so many more people at a much more cost-effective way.
Yeah. And I was, I started off wanting to be an academic. I was in graduate school at George Mason University, and it's kind of comical to go back and read the journal articles that you would write as a wannabe academic, because, you know, all the big words. And
that was just the title.
And you know, the title alone covered the first page, and you'd have all these footnotes. And these were very important articles that had a potential audience of maybe a dozen people. And somewhere along the way, I wrote my first Wall Street Journal editorial, 800 words, and I just did the math. Like, I could reach 12 people with an article that I would spend 3 months writing, or I could reach that audience at the Wall Street Journal. And I went from wanting to be an academic to wanting to be a communicator that could translate substantial ideas in a way that people would understand. And Free the People is the culmination of that. But you and I have done lots of legacy media stuff, and I'm old enough to remember when Walter Cronkite would tell me every evening in 20-minute allocated segments, that's the way it is. You remember this. Young people don't realize that they couldn't Google it. They couldn't question the master, because he got the last word on everything. And some sort of media industrial complex decided what we would know about and what we didn't get to know. And so it made information very difficult, very scarce, very sticky. And fast forward to technology and the internet. And I still, even though we could go deep into all the reasons why we should be skeptical of the new censorship, but this really does level the playing field. We have an opportunity now to talk to almost everybody, and at least everybody that's curious enough to want to understand how the world works. And it might be engineering, it might be epidemiology. Now we've all become amateur epidemiologists. It might be economics, it might be philosophy, whatever it is, you can self-curriculate.
Is that a word?
It's not a word, but
I like it.
I can't think of a better way to say that. And to me, that's like radically democratic, right? You no longer are dependent on elites to tell you what you're allowed to think.
Yeah.
And we should always be optimistic about that. And I think in a lot of ways, the insane censorship and this whole apparatus that's designed to keep us from speaking our minds is a reaction to the fact that we're winning the conversation just by being free to think for ourselves.
What I'm interested in, and I've been thinking a fair bit about recently, is the ideas of liberty and freedom seem to be having a resurgence. They seem to be. It's hard to say for sure, because sometimes we live in a bit of a bubble. What I'm wondering is, I mean, all of what you've just spoken about is a result of the internet, let's be honest. The internet has caused this moment in time. It's very easy to look back now as well. I think I've got a lot more clarity looking back and seeing, oh my God, it was the internet. It really was. Everyone was saying it at the time, but now you can see, blimey, it's destroying everything. It's destroying all the legacy institutions. It's destroying everything. So what I want to know is, does that mean that ideas of liberty have never had a place to come out, and now they are coming out? You know, they were gatekept before, right? Like you say, we're now in this place where there's free information rushing around. Do you think now is the time, and do you think now there's going to be a lot of people hearing these ideas for the first time,
yeah,
and realizing, you know, this makes total sense to me?
Yeah, I do. And I think you're right when you said that our ideas were censored, for lack of a better word, because, you know, there's the media industrial complex, there's the defense industrial complex, the COVID industrial complex, and they all strive or thrive on bigger government and bigger spending. And so our message didn't resonate with them, and it was against what their business model would help them with. I just saw an article this morning where CNN was announcing a new show with Magic Johnson and some woman. I don't even remember her name. Her last name was King or Queen. But it said in this article that CNN's viewership in March dropped 61%. And they're hoping that this show, which is going to be about politics, but not political, was how they phrased it, is going to somehow bring all of these viewers back. But a 61% drop in just 1 month.
Okay, I'm going to dork out because I'm thinking of also big academia talk about the ultimate gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. And there's this famous story that I believe is true where Sir John Templeton, who ended up starting the IEA, the first think tank in London, went to Frederick Hayek and said, I'm going to run for office because I want to change the world. And Hayek said, no, don't do that. We need to engage in this battle of ideas. And he wrote this great piece that everyone should read, the Intellectuals and Socialism, where he's worrying about the secondhand dealers and ideas, so-called intellectuals. And I think the article's funny because it's kind of like me. Like I'm a intellectual in the way that Hayek would say so, which was not a compliment. It was like you don't know enough to, and you're spouting off on all this stuff. But that whole idea controlling the narrative that what was allowed to get oxygen, that whole thing has collapsed. And again, because of technology and also the unsustainability of higher education and the cartel that it is. So I think, yes, we should be thinking expansively and radically and optimistically about what we can do with these new tools. But it also means that Hayek's advice to Sir John Templeton no longer really applies. Like, this is no longer a top-down thing where if you want to change the world, you should become an academic and sort of take control of the levers of that top of the intellectual food chain. Now you can go straight to people. And Terry mentioned CNN earlier, and I forget the exact number, but it is true that CNN, Fox News, and MSNBC, or just NBC, the whole NBC universe, is on the eve of the election in the United States. That entire population that consumes those three channels is still smaller than one episode of Joe Rogan. Hmm. That is an awesome thing because it means that they no longer get to gatekeep what we know. And you know, podcasters and people that are willing to have open and honest conversations that aren't this confrontational shout match that you see on Fox and MSNBC, that is the future. And I think you can sort of quickly realize why young people flock to Rogan, because he doesn't tell them what to think. He doesn't insult their intelligence. He just is a curious guy trying to figure out how stuff works.
It's interesting as well. I think they not only gatekept the actual content, they gatekept the way you consumed it as well.
Yeah.
And that's, I find that the most radical thing about it. I mean, I never thought I'd sit and listen to people for 4 hours. I really didn't. It was not on my radar like 5 years ago. And I've said this to many people before. I've had some of the most pivotal moments of my life recently, mowing the lawn with some earbuds in, going, oh my God, you know, that's incredible. You know, I'm going to change my life because of what this person just told me, you know, who's sitting in a room thousands of miles away, like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and that's even more important. You know, your kind of classic headline, sub-edited nonsense. People get the option now to go straight. Like, if you want to know about something, you know 100%, if you look hard enough, you're going to find an expert talking for 2 hours about it. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't you? And thank God that the media underestimated the human being as well, because, you know, everyone's doing it. I'm even watching YouTube with two people sitting there talking, like, transfixed on content that costs the price of a room and a few mics if you do it well, you know.
And by the way, this is one of the many reasons why academia, the entire financial structure of it, is collapsing, because you can get an average professor and pay some insane amount of money per year for the privilege of sitting in that classroom with that professor, or you can go online and find the best guy.
Yeah.
And it's free. It's usually free. And so this goes back to self-curriculating. You can do that for yourself. You have to be motivated. You have to be curious. But why would you spend a couple hundred grand for a college education when you could in fact get the good things that come from a classical liberal education without burdening yourself for the first 20 years of your work life.
I want to talk about the tools that we use, because I had, you know, like most of us, every morning I get up and open the computer. AI has completely changed. You know, last week I thought I was on top of it all, and I've got it doing some stuff, and I'm going, this is great. And then this morning it's like, no, something, you need to move on already, right? It's crazy. What do you think about writing in the future? What do you think about writing articles and stuff?
I have not done any of these AI experiments, and as someone that...
I think our team would quit if we even attempted to do anything.
Yeah, it's
AI.
Funny, because our team is half artists and half... So they're all creators, half of them write, half of them create, and they're all freaked out about AI, particularly my artist, because he's afraid that he'll be replaced by that. And I don't think that's true, because I think, as I understand AI, and I'm not this apocalyptic guy that thinks that we're all going to be in the Matrix in 15 years when the robots take over, it's all AI is ultimately is an average of things that have been done. And the spark of human creativity is about some sort of creative new thing that happens. And that could be in visual art, it could be in written art, and I don't think that you can replace that with a machine. So we're gonna learn with all of these new technologies. We were just talking about how the internet so radically transformed the world in a positive way. I'm not convinced that AI is somehow so fundamentally different that suddenly technology is a bad thing. I don't think that's true.
So I think that there is a place that AI will possibly take over, which is kind of like the middle market mass consumer. Hallmark movies, there's a very specific script for a Hallmark movie, right? Like an overworked female executive goes to Vermont for a weekend and meets the innkeeper, and he convinces her to stay.
And he's totally ripped.
Yeah. I mean, so I could, like, AI could write that. AI could produce...
AI could write that better, actually.
Right. And they could produce, like, all of the horrible artwork that we see in hotels, right? So, I mean, better.
Yeah.
So I do think that there will be a place for it, but there's always going to be human creativity that AI can't surpass.
I had these comic book artists, and one of the guys on our team, our creative director Matt Battaglia, is also an accomplished comic book artist, and they were all sort of in this despondent state that they were going to be replaced by robots, but they also were, I believe, the first comic book company, and I can't remember the name of the company now. They actually punched a script into AI and had it do the artwork for a comic. And it worked for that. It's very disconcerting. It only works if you like freaky dystopian things, because it doesn't really get the human experience very well.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So if you want to do something super creepy, yeah, maybe robots can do that for you. But again, like, if you want to create something really beautiful and profound and something that no one had ever exactly thought about before, I think you need a person to do that.
Yeah, I mean, like what you just said about they take the average of everything that's happened before, I thought was a great way to put it, but it's never going to, I don't think it can innovate.
It's a bit like, I mean, I'm thinking at it as well from a sort of business perspective. You know, you're still going to be able to make money, say, or in your business. But roughly the same thing happened in the print industry. The middle of the bell curve has been decimated. But now, if you want to buy a specialist magazine, you can buy these one of 100 mags for like $30. You know, and people buy them religiously. So, maybe that's true. I was thinking of it in terms of the bell curve. There, I couldn't help thinking. You know, the top end of the bell curve will remain human. I mean, my original question was actually meant: do you think there's going to be any merit in written stuff in general? I don't even mean whether.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Because that's what I'm coming to terms with now in my work is written stuff is getting superseded because AI can translate everything, can turn, you know, can turn stuff into speech, can, you know, can do all this kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, and search is not going to be something you type necessarily. I don't know. I'm making it up as I go along, like everyone else. But if I look back through my own process, so I was like you guys, I'm a storyteller, but it took me a while to understand that. And in the beginning, I was a photographer, photojournalist. I'm really obviously telling stories. And then because of the nature of the media, I moved into film because my camera suddenly started shooting film. And I was like, wow. And then I realized, wow, this is a much better medium for telling stories. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's much better. Yeah. You know, one photo, and I'm not one of those people that believes you can take a photo that just is so majestic that it's, you know, no, it's nonsense. 5 minutes on camera and I can get more information than the best photo that's ever been created. And then we get to long form conversation from there. Now I don't care about film even. I look at film and I think, okay, we're going to sit here for 45 minutes. I could do a film and then I'm going to be editing it for God knows how long and then it's going to go backwards and forwards and this and that. How many people am I reaching? And how many people now with AI... I'll give you an example. I interviewed someone yesterday who is turning all of their spoken word into foreign languages and AI avatars are saying it. You know,
yeah.
Imagine the power of that. This conversation, even small little conversation, suddenly 5-10 languages with avatars at the touch of a button. That's incredible.
It's funny because I would always have considered myself a decent writer, and that was my evolution, is to trying to take complex ideas and make them simple and accessible stories for people to consume. And but when we started Free the People, we didn't know what our medium was going to be. We just said, we want to reach young people outside of our bubble. We called them the Liberty Curious Generation. And within 6 months, I think, we essentially became a video production company. Because that storytelling, and the simple fact is that this is how young people consume information. Now, we've gone from very short stories because Facebook lied to us and they told us that young people had short attention spans, when in fact Facebook manipulated your attention span. And a lot of young people fled Facebook because they hated that manipulated experience, and they started going to podcasts and YouTube and binging on Netflix, wherever they went. And again, if it's content that was good and spoke to them and was curated by them and not imposed by some algorithm, they'll watch Lex Friedman for 6 hours. Like, who does that? But if you choose to do that, it makes a lot of sense, and it's how to learn. So we continue to evolve in our business model. From at first it was short, quippy content, and then evolved into long form documentaries or just stories about people either accomplishing beautiful things or being prevented from accomplishing beautiful things by being oppressed because government is stopping them from do that. And now we've evolved into, we're doing our first comedy projects, and we're going to start to do more narrative filmmaking because we think the market is probably saturated with documentary content, and we need to experiment to see what turns people on.
But we've also gone full circle, and we hired a young guy who actually understands TikTok. And so he's now tasked with taking all of these hundreds of hours of video content that we've made and cutting them into small slices and bits for TikTok, with the hope that eventually they'll find their way to the longer form and learn something deeper.
But I mean, that's interesting because I reckon you'll think similarly thinking with me. Have you stopped the long form documentary completely? Because it's super expensive, isn't it? When you compare it to a long form, like a Lex Friedman podcast, still long.
Yeah.
But look at the overheads on something like that. It's like practically nothing. Really.
Yeah. We haven't abandoned it. And I think part of our business model that I think is innovative is, like, it's not that expensive for us. So our team is all in-house, and we keep them very busy, and they're very well paid and they're very talented, but we produce a tremendous amount of stuff. And I think hiring a third party to do documentary stuff can be wildly expensive. So I think we've tackled the economics of that so that And we also don't like, I don't want to offend anybody, but if you're spending a year to sort of do pre-production for a documentary, we go the whole process in a couple of weeks, and we do the shoot, and the editing obviously takes more than a couple of weeks, but
that's what I mean though.
Yeah.
That's the bane of my life, editing. Yeah. I mean, the last film I made, I insisted we had a 5-day edit at the end of it. And I said, I'll deliver at the end of that 5 days. And then I'm walking away. If you want to jig it after that, it's up to you. You can take it. But I can't stand the editing process anymore. I absolutely despise it.
I mean, our team, like most people, will take as long to edit as we give them. So we've learned to have very strong deadlines and it works. But, you know, he said that all of our, you know, our staff is already on our payroll. So it's all sunk cost. And the very first documentary that we did 5 years ago that is still paying dividends today was a documentary about Thomas Massie. It's called Off the Grid with Thomas Massie. He's a Republican congressman and he lives the most environmentally sound life that any hardcore environmentalist would want. I mean, completely off the grid, solar power, water from a well. He built his house by hand, literally he and his sons, and it's this beautiful timber home. And somebody asked us, well, how much did that cost? And our response was 4 tanks of gas and a couple cases of beer. And we shot it over the weekend and we stayed at Thomas's house. I mean, obviously there's
we were paying these people, so
right.
It's a little bit of a joke because they were on payroll, but that documentary was just featured randomly, unexpectedly in this huge New York Times feature piece. It was like 3 or 4 weeks ago, mm-hmm. I guess. And it shed this, and this congressman is a very libertarian. He's a registered Republican because libertarians don't win office in the States, but he's basically a libertarian who's got this folksy redneck homespun way of explaining, you know, self-reliance and stewardship to the land and all of these obviously libertarian values. And inexplicably, because the story was compelling, and because the congressman refused to talk to the New York Times, thinking they're just going to write a nasty hit piece about him, they wrote a very positive, empathetic piece about him. I mean, their hardcore viewers were kind of pissed off about it because why are you saying nice things about this guy? So I have this. I think this may be a made up word, but there's
another one.
Yeah.
There's earned media where you go on somebody else's show, or you go on MSNBC and get shouted at, or whatever that is. There's paid media where you just run ads to tell your story the way you want, and then there's created media, which is this narrative storytelling that we've been talking about. That is, if it's authentic and well done, it changes everything in a way that allows you to tell your story the way you wanted to tell it, not the way that someone else is going to manipulate it by, you know, cutting and pasting and asking hostile questions and all the things that happens in old media. So we've always argued that that was happening, and then the New York Times proved it, which was kind of cool.
So what are you aiming at now then? When you produce a bit of content, obviously it's eyeballs you're after, or ears or whatever. So, you know, what are your kind of, what's on the top of your list now? When you think, right, this is where we want this to be placed, or this is where we want it to be seen, you know?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, because things are changing so quickly, we're struggling with that. You know, we had relied on YouTube and Facebook, and that's, you know, even YouTube is a little bit of a bigger struggle than it has been. So we are working on that. Like, we are working in placing our documentaries in film festivals to try to reach different audiences that way, and to try to pick up a distribution deal, even as a nonprofit. But it's a question that keeps me up at night. Like, where do we put this out there? How do we get the eyeballs or the...
The rules keep changing. And I think, you know, we hate clickbait with a burning passion. We want to reach audiences who aren't necessarily already coming to our church or belonging to our tribe. We want to reach new audiences. And the very nature of social media makes that a more difficult project in the first place. On top of that, there is absolutely soft censorship happening for our type of content. And we're not like right wing angry. We're not the types of people you would expect to be targeted by social media, but they still make it quite difficult. And I also think, 5 years ago, my public Facebook page had like 1.5 million people on it. And it was a great place to distribute our content. And we would get millions and millions of views. And now I can't get 3 likes from 1 million people. And I'm like, okay, so they want me to pay again to talk to my same community. So that's essentially worthless. Facebook is worthless in terms of reaching audience. But we keep endlessly experimenting with new platforms. And I'm curious to see what Twitter becomes, because Elon Musk clearly has some ambitions to compete with YouTube and other places as well. And he's not perfect, but he seems to be more committed to an open platform that allows you to talk to people. And they're obviously not there yet. It's pretty not functional right now, but that's fine. Like it was a pretty screwed up place.
Yeah. It's been fun watching Elon actually morph into the person he is. If you have any sort of libertarian leanings, you've noticed a change in the guy, haven't you? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden he's been sort of knocking up against sort of government overreach so many times. It's like something like the penny dropped, and now it's like he's on a mission, which I find really exciting. I agree with you at the moment. I've always been interested in Twitter anyway, because it's a great place to get news, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I agree, he'll want to do something with that now. He's got the free speech platform, supposedly, so he'll want to do something with it. And what are your favorite productions that you've made so far, the ones that you hold dearest to your heart, and what were they about?
Well, so my favorite documentary is one that we are releasing this year called The Free Life, Portrait of an Artist. And it's a story about this amazing artist from Cuba who, when he was 13 years old, his grandmother said, if you want to be a true artist, you're going to have to leave your country. And he made his way through Mexico and has been living in Miami, and is incredibly successful, and his art is beautiful, and he has these great, very anti-Castro pieces as well. And his story is just absolutely incredible. And I'm very proud of that. And I think even I was talking with someone, and his response was, well, hasn't, the Cuba story been done too much? And I said no, and pointed to last year's riots and demonstrations in Cuba, where they had, hundreds of thousands of people protesting in the streets for freedom based on Twell's song. And so I think it's a good reminder for people. And Cuba's in the news. They still have because of those demonstrations, there was 1,000 people arrested, and people are serving prison sentences of like 25 years.
Cuba came up on my feed this morning. People were driving boats over and mm-hmm. dropping stuff off and meeting in the middle of the ocean and stuff. Just randomly, I was like, oh, I don't know why. I didn't even know about that stuff. But it did, I know what you mean. Yeah.
But that was one of the stories that we like. And this goes back to a project we did in Serbia, maybe 4 years ago now. We discovered a pattern when we're telling stories about the abuses of authoritarianism. And you learn that authoritarians almost always target artists and actors and poets and the creative class first, because they are, or at least were, the creative thinkers, the dissidents, the ones that were willing to speak truth to power. And we documented this in a thing about Tito in Yugoslavia. But as you see this, you see that, Castro banned the Beatles, and the Soviet Union had a blacklist of rock and roll bands that you couldn't listen to, which were all my favorite bands. And it was kind of ridiculous. Like, I think Van Halen was...
Oh, we have the whole list.
I don't know. I have the whole list, but it was ridiculous. Like, the Village People were fascists, and it's like
they banned Julio Iglesias too.
Yeah, Julio Iglesias was banned. It doesn't matter. And it kind of goes back to the Velvet Revolution, which was literally started by an underground band, the Plastic People of the Universe, inspired by Frank Zappa, and go full circle to Vaclav Havel. Took a lot of his inspiration from Zappa. So there's there's this artistic integrity that, again, is a very libertarian idea that I think is a great way to reach young people or for who, for whatever reason, have been convinced that this democratic socialism is a really cool thing and I won't have to work and I can be my creative self. And it's like, no, the first people that go to the gulags are the creators.
Well, and we just started watching that series, Intercontinental. I forget, it's based on a true story from World War II about a woman in France, and she spent a year and smuggled 2,000 writers and artists out of France when it was, you know, occupied by the Nazis. And so the persecution of artists goes back.
But it's a different way, instead of just thinking about, you know, we always make the economic argument as to why socialism fails. But we can make the cultural argument as to why socialism is a noxious, intolerant ideology that is the opposite of what the cool kids will tell you.
Or better yet, tell the positive story of people, the entrepreneurs and the successful people that succeed in spite of government. We did a documentary, just a short documentary, about this crazy brewer named Vladimir in Belgrade, Serbia. And we actually connected him with a brewer in the United States, Jim Caruso of Flying Dog, and they did a collaboration of beer. And Matt, because he always has to, you know, quote Dead Economist, he got a Bastiat quote in there, but, you know, they used to say when goods cross borders, troops don't. And so you have this brewer in Serbia doing collaborations of beer with people from all of these countries around Serbia that they used to fight with. And he talks about, you know, going around walls. And he says, well, sometimes I go over them, sometimes I go through them, sometimes under, but I always get on the other side. And it's just such a great positive way of looking at things.
Yeah, so there's a new entrepreneurial mindset in these former Soviet satellite countries, where if you went right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, you would discover that they still had that inability to problem solve because they were never allowed to solve problems. And the new generations are going to run circles around the United States if the United States isn't careful, because there is that sense that I'm free to create, I'm free to accomplish things, and I'm going to do that. And that that part of our story, the uplifting, beautiful things that happen when people are free to cooperate, that's what we aspire to tell. Mm-hmm. And we're better, the royal we, all libertarians, we're pretty good at talking about how badly government sucks. Mm-hmm. But we're not as good about this beautiful thing. The communities that are created and the unbelievable solutions that no one thought was possible. And it's not just about the Elon Musks of the world. It's about everybody doing that, just that process of figuring out the world and dealing with uncertainty and dealing with problems that come up that you didn't expect. Decentralized solutions create beautiful things. And I think we have to spend more time putting a face and allowing people to get emotionally attached to that brewer that's making unbelievably awesome beer in a place you'd never expect to find it.
It's the perfect pitch for libertarian media, as far as I'm concerned. We have this conversation all the time. The best PR is to notice what pockets of freedom have given rise to, find a person, tell their story. It's like so obviously good.
Yeah.
It's what we're doing. We have at Free Cities, you know, we do exactly the same thing. Go to places where Free Cities exist, find what's different, who's doing what, why is it, how has it affected in a good way, rather than, yeah, like you say, slagging everyone off all the time, which... Mm-hmm. We can do it in private, I think.
Yeah.
But it doesn't gain any friends out in the real world, I don't think.
Right.
It's the, you know, and also I think it's one of the PR problems with libertarianism in general. It's always against something.
Yeah.
Rather than I'm for freedom. And, you know, the ways that you can show that is very easy if you have any storytelling experience. Going back to something you said, what's up with democratic socialism? How they're doing really well. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got some great characters. I'd put them as the number one sort of, you know, opposition to
threat
to what we're doing. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've done a lot of thinking about trying to be empathetic when you listen to our young democratic socialist rock star, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And she says a lot of things that objectively are sort of patently ridiculous, like my generation has never known real prosperity. And she, of course, grew up in the richest county, in the richest state, in the richest country at the richest time in the entire history of humanity. So she's not right about that. But she talks about something that I think it's almost Jordan Peterson-esque in the sense that she talks a lot about dignity. And I think a lot of young people are struggling to find purpose, and in some ways we're victims of our own success, where, you know, if you don't get the new iPad, you're devastated and you're a victim and it's not fair. But the fact that we don't worry about the things that we used to worry about in the United States. We used to worry 100 years ago, am I going to be able to feed my kids this winter? Are we going to have enough food? Am I going to be able to put a roof over their head? Just basic questions of survival, which amongst many other things gives you purpose. Like, I got to go out and work my ass off just to accomplish these goals. And now we are struggling with meaning because, you know, we've solved a lot of those problems and prosperity and this beautiful distributed network of people that keep us fed and clothed. That's a thing that was created by freedom. But where do you get meaning in life? And I think, again, we have a better answer to that question. I think there's dignity in work, in controlling your own destiny, in trying to accomplish things and failing. And the only thing I'd say about Jordan Peterson is he's a very dark outlook. And I don't think it has to be dark at all. I think it's beautiful when people are free to struggle. And if you've never failed, you've probably never felt good about yourself either, because you never tried that hard.
I mean, I'm going to go back to my favorite AOC quote. I was going to do air quotes, but realizing it's not video, that would not have made any difference, where she said, it's better to be morally right than to be factually correct. Mm-hmm. And that's why they win, because they do stories, and it's moral and it's empathy. And our side talks about facts and figures. And so you will never change someone's mind with that. It always just goes back to storytelling. But I was also thinking about Bernie Sanders when he was, you know, running for president, and all of the things that he was railing against, we all agreed with, right? Endless war, the war on drugs. You go down the list and it was like, oh, I agree with Bernie, but we don't agree with his solutions. And so our solution is always freedom, and their solution is always more government.
So how do you communicate that? How do you communicate that best? What's our hook? If they've got dignity, or they've got,
we shouldn't, one of the things we shouldn't do is give up the good words. Like, dignity should be our word.
Sure.
And community should be our word. And even I know some libertarians get all bent out of shape about the word democratic, because they're thinking about vulgar democracy where 51% of the people get to do whatever they want to 49%. But to me, democratic is a far more expansive concept where power is shifted back to the end user. So we should use words like democratic and not socialism, but the word social. We sometimes sound like we're antisocial. And the whole reason that freedom is so powerful is not because of what you might do, but what you might do with other people in voluntary cooperation. So I think the language we use is really important. And in the States, at least, you know, they talk, the democratic socialists talk about social justice. And we know that's kind of a perversion of the concept of justice. But as a result, we're giving up that word too. And I think, and by the way, these are very value-laden words, and they have they carry moral weight when people use them or abuse them. So I think part of it is you developing a value-based way of connecting with people at an emotional level. And I think a personal story always does that better, and as opposed to an abstract thing. But I also think that we should come to terms with the fact that I'm an economist, I process the world through supply and demand, and I'm a freak. That's not normal. And that's not how humans think about the world. They process the world through their emotions, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's also just the way it is. So let's get comfortable, as passionately as we are behind closed doors about lifting people up and problem solving. That should be reflected in our work. But when you go, like we're at this conference, and sometimes you go to these conferences with very passionate people that have this massive spreadsheet up there to show us the math on why too much government involvement in healthcare can lead to rationing and people not getting the care they need. And if AOC was up there, she'd tell this story about a mom mm-hmm. who couldn't get help for her child.
So that was just a really long way of saying that you just have to make it personal and tell a story. Mm. And that's how you reach people.
Are you getting, take this Liberty Con, a lot of youngsters here. How do you feel about, have you been mixing, watching, observing? How do you feel about young people and this movement? Are they getting it? Apart from the guy that showed all the graphs and stuff.
I think it depends on what country they're from. We've found such a bigger passion from kids that are coming from former Soviet countries, Serbia, that kind of thing, versus the students that are coming here from France. We should just write France off the, just give up on them. But we find a bigger passion here in Europe than we do when we're speaking to groups in the United States, because it's not so bad there. Mm-hmm. But we have a very good friend, Pedar, from Belgrade, and he drove us past Block 37, which was the apartment complex that he grew up in. And it was a cinder block, massive, horrible structure that sucked the life out of me just driving mm-hmm. past. And so these people actually have firsthand understanding and knowledge of what big government can do to you. And they have this incredible thirst for freedom.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons we come here and we speak is it's incredibly uplifting to meet so many young people that are interested in this stuff. And both the, I was picking on the guy with the spreadsheet.
That was you one day.
Yeah, I'm sure I did that once. But that's not really what you're discovering. Like I got into these ideas because I was one of those dorky kids that read the right books. And again, there was like a couple dozen of us that did that. But that's not this community. Like some of those guys are here, but you have tremendous diversity. And by the way, there's almost as many women as there are men, which is a clear sign of a vibrant social movement. But they're not all like wannabe academics. They have this entire distributed skill set that's going to do all these things that we're talking about, which is why we come. And our talk in a couple minutes will be ultimately the importance of telling a story and reaching new audiences with empathy and to think wildly expansively about our potential, because their biggest challenge is that their audience is way too big. Like, what are you going to do with all these potential customers? And our problem was, can I get on MSNBC where they're going to shout at me? And that's a closed system. This is an open system, and we can... I just want them to think radically expansively and optimistically about what they can accomplish.
I agree with you. going back a few minutes when you were talking about Jordan Peterson and purpose, and I think if you can inspire the purpose, and obviously for me the purpose is freedom, that's a really powerful one. Everyone loves their purpose. People that haven't got it crave it. People who've got it, it gets them up in the morning. Mm-hmm. Jordan Peterson's right on that one. Meaning is, super important. And I think, freedom's the meaning for me. Anyway, you are speaking in a few minutes and I can see my time's up, but I've got one last question for you. It's a traditional question we ask everyone on this podcast. You have a 1 year sabbatical paid for. So you've got a patron who's giving you money to do whatever you want for a year. What are you going to do?
Since we're going to make this up, I am going to make the movie that I've always wanted to make.
Which is?
I don't know. I don't have the budget.
You've got the budget now.
I thought you were going to say you're going to just drop everything and go to every single remaining Grateful Dead show.
Yeah.
Which is what he would
you
actually
do. You could do them both. Do. What's the film?
This year is the last tour of my beloved Grateful Dead. But what I would do is just because we've been short on time is we are writing a book together. And it's based on a series of talks that we've started giving together over the last 4 or 5 years. That again is just based on storytelling, and I am a very different speaker when I'm speaking with my wife because she doesn't let me get away with certain
quoting debt economists all the time.
Certain things that I would do otherwise,
making up words and all that stuff. Yeah.
So you would take a year and write a book. Can we do that in some like really amazing exotic location?
Yeah, it's all paid. You've got a year. It's paid for.
What are you gonna do?
I'm gonna travel. I'm gonna see all the places that I haven't been able to see.
All right.
Fair enough. I look forward to your book, and I look forward to seeing you in Thailand or wherever it is.
Well, where we will be writing the book.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, Matt and Terry, thanks. It's been fab talking to you. Too short. Hopefully we'll run into each other another time, but thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you.